Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, and today it is my pleasure to have as a return guest to the podcast, Dr. Radha Masurya. Radha is a UK-trained doctor with over 10 years of experience working in the NHS and beyond. Having worked in hospitals across the UK and in developing countries, she brings a global perspective to her mission of transforming healthcare. As a doctor and coach, she's dedicated to helping doctors break free from their limiting beliefs to create lasting change. Her approach goes beyond quick fixes or temporary solutions. It's about empowering individuals to embrace their health, build powerful rituals, and step into a radiant identity that thrives no matter life's challenges. She also hosts the Medicine Unraveled podcast, where she shares insights into functional and nutritional approaches to health and wellness, alongside strategies for medical professionals to craft balanced, optimized careers. Curiosity, growth, and resilience are at the heart of everything she does. She believes in creating ripples of positive change that will inspire and empower future generations. Radha's message, let's create a world where vibrant health isn't just a goal, it's a way of life. Radha, welcome again to the Teaching Journeys podcast. I've been excited about having you back for a while now.
Wow. Thank you so much, Dave. Likewise. And just hearing that bio, it's been a while since I shared those things. And just hearing it back, it's just like, yeah, that's the mission. That's the goal.
And you have incorporated that mission very well into your work and into your life. And, you know, again, you're the type of guest that we feature on the Teaching Journeys podcast, those that are striving to make a difference, leave a legacy, and leave some positive change in the world. So I'm just glad to have you back.
I'm grateful too. It's been a journey, and it's reconnected me to a lot of parts that I didn't realize that existed within me.
Yeah, it's amazing how the journey outside of us leads us back to the journey within and just makes us aware of things that were previously not in our conscious being. So I think every bit of service, I think, also inspires us to take a look at ourselves and continue to grow within. So,
absolutely. Yeah.
In our first episode, we talked a lot about your work as a doctor's coach. We talked about functional medicine. We talked about root cause analysis, right, and how important that is in dealing with healthcare issues that individuals present. Now we're going to kind of focus on your passion for global healthcare, your travels to other countries, what you've learned, what you can share with our audience. So I'm really excited to take a deep dive into that aspect of your life with you. So whenever you're ready, we'll get going.
Yeah, likewise. It's like you say, it's the integration. It's become part of my life, and it's a really big part. Now, when we talk about global health, just when I was preparing for this podcast, something changed. When we talk about global health generally, we're thinking healthcare globally, healthcare around the world. And I realized, as we'll explore hopefully in this podcast, is it's more about bringing the global to the healthcare in your home, in your country where you are. All the different practices from around the world. And that's where my practice has developed as a doctor, is bringing all the things I learn from around the world, not just in my volunteer work in medicine, but when I travel, when I meet new people, all of that comes into my healthcare practice.
Yeah, I really want to explore, you know, really some of the cultural practices that you've seen in other countries that can improve improve our ability to do functional medicine or improve healthcare in the areas that we live. So that's one of the areas that I want to explore with you for sure. So, my first question for you is, I think the audience would be a little curious in terms of how you developed your passion for providing healthcare in other countries, and then where exactly have your travels taken you?
Yes. So I think to know me and my journey, it's worth exploring a little bit of my family history. So I'm Indian by origin, by ancestor, if you like, but I grew up in England on a small island in the British Isles, the Isle of Man, where there were no Indians, very few people of any other culture. My great-great-grandfather, we all started off in India, but he took the first step and traveled to South Africa because of work, because of the colonization. That's where work was taking you, to Africa. My grandfather then followed and moved to Kenya. And from there, that's where both my parents are born. If you actually look into the diaspora of Indians in the world, a lot of them started off from India to Africa and then spread across the world. So just along that journey, I have Indian in me, I have South African in me, I have Kenyan in me. Now I have English, Manx, as we call ourselves in the Isle of Man. So many different aspects to me. It was almost inevitable that the global health aspect would come through.
Yeah, it sounds like there's certainly a generational history of travel, of the passion for global healthcare. And I think, as you know, even with epigenetics, I think that gets passed into our DNA without altering the genetic code. I mean, those type of traditions, those are things that we'd naturally pick up, unless, of course, the narrative is altered or reclaimed for any other reason. But it's easy to see where those roots are for you. So where have you gone? I know you were in Greece recently, but where are your travels taking you?
Yeah, so I think my first stop was Kenya. I wanted to reconnect. I got an opportunity when I was about 18 years old to go to Kenya for a project that was unrelated to medicine, as I saw it at the time. I was about to go start medical school, and it was a sand dam project. We were building dams to collect water so that they could bore holes and have water supply. And only now, again, when I reflect back, it's like, no, that is the core of medicine. That was already a medical, in quotation marks, volunteer trip for me, because without water, without nutrition, we don't have anything. So that was a trip that connected me back to my roots, the African roots. And then from there, I've been to Sierra Leone, Mexico, India, of course, Romania, and then most recently working with refugees, asylum seekers in Greece.
Well, that's a very diverse path. And
yeah.
I know you've probably picked up a lot of practices and a lot of things that I know can improve the healthcare wherever we are. So why don't I, at least since we're on that topic, what are some of the cultural practices in those countries that can improve or enhance our ability to really do functional medicine wherever part of the world that we live in? What have you discovered that has you found have been the most useful?
A thing that we forget in the Western world is actually the healing starts long before a doctor walks into the room. And it becomes more of a community healing. I saw it in Sierra Leone. I saw it in India, in Kenya. The community comes together to help that person. They bring their own traditional values, their own methods. They don't just treat the condition, they treat the whole person. They look at what could be going on here, not just this tiny little pimple that we see. What could have caused that? And it's looking at the whole person, that holistic healing. And it's less about throwing prescriptions at them. And it comes more from purpose. It comes from love. It comes from that true healing from within. I was raised with more Ayurvedic practices, spices. And, you know, we didn't go straight to a medicine or antibiotics. It was use turmeric, something that's like a big fad right now. You ginger, garlic, all of these things. I remember I was in a hotel several years ago and I overheard a lady saying, "Oh yes, I'm drinking ginger tea," and telling this friend of hers all the benefits of ginger tea. And I thought, yeah, but that came from Eastern medicine, if you like.
Yes.
Ayurveda tells you food is medicine. The Japanese culture, they make mealtime a ritual. And then you get to the Western world and everything is rushed. We almost disrespect the food by eating all the processed things or rushing our food. Yeah.
I like the inclusion of community. I mean, I know in the United States, we have family practice medicine. It might be the closest thing to community medicine that you'll see.
Yeah.
Is incorporating treatments that will deal with the entire holistic scheme of the family. Typically, I don't think we see that as consistently in the United States. It's basically treating the symptoms. It's basically symptom management without getting to root cause. But you mentioned turmeric. I use turmeric as a supplement, and I know it's a great anti-inflammatory. Yeah, me too. And I used to have a bone spur in my right heel, and I started taking turmeric. I don't have the bone spur anymore. I took it regularly. It isn't just like one and done or just take it sporadically. You have to really make it a consistent practice and a consistent part of your routine. Now, with that being said, I also believe there's benefits to Western medicine, but I think the combination of West and East makes for, I think, better healthcare outcomes, better qualities of life. And I don't think we can particularly ignore the traditions that have that other cultures, and particularly indigenous cultures, have developed. I mean, you use the light within your body to heal. And there are individuals who can get into advanced states of meditation to do that, but not everybody can. So we have to have some other alternatives. But I do like the community aspect of that. I think community heals. I think community can provide support and hope in troubling times. And I think without that, you know, the quality of our life tends to not be as good as it could be.
Right. I love what you say, because does Western style medicine have a place? Absolutely. Yet when you look back, how long have we had all of that technology and advancement? Hundreds of years. How long have humans been around? Thousands, if not more. So yes, medicine has advanced and we have all of this new technology, the most incredible hospitals, but have we ourselves evolved? We've just learned to prolong life, but we're not always enhancing it. And I think we need to stop looking or even chasing that longevity and start actually creating vitality.
Yes. Yes. I mean, we can prolong life, but at the expense of quality of life. And if that's the case, is prolonging life really the way to go? In the United States, there's 11 states in the union that have aid in dying legislation where individuals, if they qualify, if they're 18 years of age and older, and they have 6 months left to live, they can qualify for aid in dying. And, you know, I believe that should be an option in every state in the United States. I believe that should be an option everywhere as another healthcare option. Not to replace any healthcare options, but just as another option to explore. I mean, I look at it right now, you know, we don't have any control when we come into this world. We should have some ability to self-determine how and when we leave if circumstances dictate that.
That's really interesting, because from my experience globally and the way I've grown up is, I think even socially here, we tell everyone we don't have any control over our death. And I think one of the best ways of expressing how I see it is, in Sierra Leone, we had a very primitive setup. You have the hospital, you have certain facilities, certain medications, and they will bring people who have traveled days, walked days to come and see, because they heard there's a doctor, a Western doctor. There's so much emphasis put onto that.
Mm-hmm.
And this person by that point is so sick. They've done all of their traditional medicine, so they don't disregard the fact that a Western doctor could help them. But in that journey, they've also come to terms with the fact that, okay, at this point, if they can do something, amazing. And if they can't, then that was meant to be. That was their time.
Yes. Yeah.
And no matter how much we did, sometimes we weren't able to save everybody. And it was more the Western doctors that were struggling with the fact, because we have it in our head that we should be able to do everything. Whereas they, as the family and as the community, they never actually blamed us. They came together and said, if anything, they were helping to comfort us and help us understand that it was their time. We really appreciate you gave him that extra time, gave us that hope. But time is time.
Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong. I know in the Eastern philosophy, and you know, that individuals are, cultures that have the Eastern philosophy, they look at death as a part of life, and they embrace the knowledge of their death to try to lead the best possible life that they can for the time that they have. And I've talked about this with my students in death, dying, and bereavement. In Western medicine, doctors take death personally. They know that it's part of the deal, that they're not going to be able to save anybody, but they still take it personally. It's something that bothers them immensely, so they're going to rely on a lot of technological procedures to prolong life, even when quality of life may be compromised, because they just have that relationship with death, that it's somehow, I could have done more to prevent that. I need to do more to prevent that. But I know Atul Gawande, in his book, Being Mortal, and I forgot the subtitle, he quoted a hospice study, I think in 2008, that indicated that individuals that end up life in the last week of their life, if they were going through chest compressions, any other type of intrusive procedures, it did improve their quality of life. And if anything, for the family members, that it had to traumatize the family members. And it was documented that many of the family members experienced symptoms of depressions for 6 months after their loved one died. So the question, and I think Gawande poses this, is when does quality of life become a priority? What do we need to do to ensure that there's quality of life in the end of life chapter, and that person is going out in their final chapter doing the treatments that they wish to be doing? What can they also do to enhance their spiritual and emotional well-being at the end of their life? He was looking, I think, a more hospice-oriented approach is what I think he was hoping Western medicine would adopt down the road. And he questioned, is traditional Western medicine really working to meet the end-of-life needs of those individuals that we serve? His book did that quite nicely.
Right. Now, if you go one step further and look at Eastern communities, families, there's this generational living. You don't send your elderly parents into a care home. You don't leave them to live on their own. Everybody is living together. And so they are taken care of. You almost have hospice at home. And they're looked after. And that quality of life is very different at that point. It's just an extension of, it's not a part of being old. It's not elderly care. It's just part of your life. And that's what we get focused on. We need to have quality of life at the end of our life, but why not throughout? And that's where I hear it in communities all the time, like online, where people are complaining, the doctor didn't give me this medicine, or the doctor did give me this medicine, but they want the medicine. These patients, they're complaining, they're saying, I need this medicine, I need that medicine. But they don't see that the medicine isn't going to fix everything. And there's going to be side effects from that, which they're also going to complain about. So when does that end? When does the quality of life begin?
Yes.
You know, you have the disease, you suffer with the symptoms. You have the medication, you suffer with the side effects. And then suddenly you're old and now you're looking at quality of life.
Yeah, that's a good point. Quality of life should matter throughout our entire life cycle, not just an end of life. Even though quality of life is a decision that is, when does quality of life become compromised at end of life? But you're right. We should be thinking of quality of life throughout the entire part of our life to increase our vitality, to increase our ability to engage. And whenever it is, it's deemed that we exit this world, that we've lived a good quality life and enriched with friends, with community, with legacy, engaging with purpose. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. That's what I feel is lost once you medicalize things. And we need to empower ourselves more and understand, take responsibility for that, stop outsourcing it, have a participation in it.
How do we effectively do that, Radha? Because I know one of the things that tends to occur, and I'm not saying this occurs all the time, but we place a lot of trust, esteem in our medical practitioners that they have the answers. So therefore, we feel that, well, maybe it's not our right to question, maybe it's not our right to participate. How do we find the balance between respecting the expertise of Western medicine and empowering ourselves to really say, hey, these are some of the treatments that I really want to consider. How does it become more of a collaborative process?
Yeah, great question. And for anybody listening, I want you to know that actually you give the doctor, your healthcare profession, more respect by asking those questions. When I was going through medical school, they were teaching us that the past way was a paternalistic way of healing or treating patients. There was a comical video that they would show us. The patient is lying there. The whole group comes in, the team, the nurse, the doctor, everything in their lab coats, stands there, talks about the patient. There's a key scene in Patch Adams, if you've seen the movie. And, you know, it's all discussed. The diabetic with the gangrenous foot, and they discuss the whole treatment plan. And then he pipes up at the end of the bed, but what is the name of the patient?
Yes.
Let's stop talking about the patient as a number and a diagnosis. What is the name of the patient? And that transition from going from a paternalistic where he's just dictating, the doctor stands at the end of the bed, dictates what happens, the patient just lies there, terrified or not, takes what's going to happen. You want to chop my leg off? You know best. To now involving them in the decision-making, which is where the UK medical system is going. Patients have still not transitioned into, I get a say, I get to say whether I want to take that medicine or not. There's still a lot of fear to the point where we discussed in the last episode, going from sick care to healthcare.
Yes.
And I would even dare to say now it's going from healthcare to self-care. That's where we have the knowledge out there. There's plenty of information thanks to social media at this point. You can type in to ChatGPT if you wanted and get all of the answers. It's actually empowering ourselves and taking that responsibility and saying, look, the information is there. The health professional knows I have all of this information. It's not doubting the health professional. It's saying, this is what I want. I'll give you an example of a client that I have right now. He was completely against having a bypass, a heart bypass. He said, I've had a heart attack. I don't want this barbaric procedure. And he was terrified to say that. He plucked up the courage. He told the medical professional, the cardiologist, and he says, I don't want this procedure. I want to do it naturally. Give me the information for doing it naturally. And he had nothing. He was almost told off and told, well, then you're just going to die. That's the only option. You either have the bypass or you die. And he chose still not to have the bypass. And we've been working together. He's recovering so well. He's almost better than any other non-cardiac patient. The underlying story here, though, is patients, people and patients were all the same. They don't feel like they can say something. They haven't empowered themselves. They have the understanding. He'd done his research. He knew what the risks were of not doing this. And he knew what he wanted to do. It's just that empowering feeling. And any medics that are out there, any healthcare professionals, you should want that for your patient, that they speak up for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That ego of a doctor shouldn't be there that says, I'm the one that knows best.
Agreed. And as you were telling the story of your client, bypassing the bypass, I know that sounds repetitive, but bypassing the bypass. I went to a doctor who believed in integrative medicine. She was very knowledgeable about acupuncture. She was knowledgeable about yoga. She was knowledgeable about herbal medicine, everything. And so I was told her that some of the things that I was doing from an integrative standpoint, from supplements to doing other spiritual practices. She said, you know, if you told most doctors that, they would fluff that off as pop science or folk science. They wouldn't even give it a second thought. And I think that's coming from somebody who's in the medical profession herself saying that about her colleagues. You can see why there's so much fear for individuals to speak up, because they just figure we're going to get dismissed anyway, or I'm just going to turn over my power to the doctor because inevitably he knows best. And a lot of times you know yourself better than anybody else knows, and includes your doctor.
Yes, definitely. Who knows you the best? That doctor who you've told this part of your story to, just that little chunk, does not know you. And we can't keep treating the symptoms and ignoring the stories that created them.
That's right.
You know, you are the one that's lived with you this whole time. You know all the individual things that have happened to lead to this body.
Yes.
And the symptoms that you're having. The doctor only knows a portion of that. So
yeah.
You might know the treatment and the medical side best, but you know you best.
You know how your body works, your body speaks, you know what's hurting, you know what isn't hurting. I've told my doctor this. I said, look, I'm feeling fine. I said, but my body usually tells me how I'm feeling and I'm in tune with that. If there's anything that's off, I'll call you. But in the meantime, if you don't hear from me, consider it to be good news that I'm okay. It's one less patient for you to be concerned with.
Yeah. Now, that's a skill. Sad to say, but that's a skill that people have lost.
Yeah.
This being aware of yourself, understanding. And that's a big part of the work that I do, is just if you understand the signals that your body is sending you, then that's half of the battle. That's that awareness. It's not necessarily external awareness. It's also internal awareness.
Yes. And I think it's something that we... is definitely developed as a skill. It's something that I think we need to believe that we have that awareness to judge for ourselves what is best for our body, what is best for our mind, what's best for our overall health, and that we should not turn that power over totally to anybody else. We should share that power, and it should be a collaborative sharing of that, but it shouldn't be, okay, I'm going to turn my power over to you. You pretty much do what you got to do to me. That's doing treatment to somebody. It's not doing treatment with somebody.
And I love that. And this element that you're saying where people might feel dismissed because they're trying an alternative route. I mean, in England, we call it complementary or traditional medicine.
Mm-hmm.
The word traditional means that's how it was.
Yes.
So culture shapes how we eat, how we sleep, how we love, how we heal. So why are we trying to take the culture out of our healthcare?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, our cultural background, our cultural practices, those of them passed on from our ancestors, dictate how we view overall health. And I think across the board, medical professionals need to be culturally sensitive to that and really as part of their, you know, find out what cultural practices they've incorporated. I think in China, they believe in traditional Western medicine, but there's also herbal medicine and acupuncture that they do regularly in conjunction. And acupuncture, this occurred, I think, long before Western medicine evolved. I mean, this has occurred for centuries and centuries and centuries. And why shouldn't we as a community of medical professionals embrace those practices, particularly if it's going to improve quality of life throughout that person's life cycle?
Yeah. And I think, sadly, I mean, I bring my spiritual knowledge into that, but there's a lot of ego in doctors that says, I know best, they must listen to me and do as I say. And when somebody comes with something else, or maybe they don't know it, they feel like maybe they're being questioned rather than just being open to it and saying, no, okay, let's explore this. What?
Mm-hmm.
I have a fun story that came to mind when you mentioned this. I was in the States with my cousin and he twisted his ankle. So the traditional Ayurvedic or Indian thing to do was to wrap it with, it's like a turmeric-based paste,
mm-hmm.
and you spread that across the joint and then you wrap it. So when we went to the doctor's, it must have happened on a Friday. We went to his doctor on the Monday. And thankfully, it was a Chinese doctor. And he says, "What's gone on here?" Obviously, his skin is all yellow. And he says, "No, no, that's not right. Like, bruising shouldn't look like this just a few days later." And we explained, and he said, "If you had gotten any other doctor, you would have been shouted at or, you know, told off for not coming in sooner for doing this. I understand that you've actually helped yourself by doing this. It's probably in a better state." But it was just a typical, an Indian mother just says, "Yeah, just do this," and it makes sense. And that's how we grew up. And it's only when you look back, once you've done medicine, the other traditional way through medical school, you see, oh, I see how that worked and this, how they combine together.
Yeah, it's something that's a sight to behold, and it's really magic to behold when you see how the two combine to create probably better outcomes than either one of those approaches singularly. So I know you've mentioned, you started talking a little bit about, you know, the UK in terms of health practices. I heard that the UK is pretty much open to a lot of complementary medicines and different types of medicines. What are some other differences in healthcare in the UK and the United States that you've seen?
So even between the UK and the States, I see a lot of differences in that we have the NHS here, and I hear a lot of patients from the States, a lot of friends from the States who say the fact that their system is more advanced but commercialized,
yes,
is actually impacting the way doctors would treat a patient. And almost on par, the UK has that advance and it's very structured and we get free medicine in quotation marks, but it's overstretched. And based on budgets, there's certain medications, certain treatments that are recommended over others, hoping that they're the best treatment, but we're still out, you know, it's an overstretched system. The commercialized on the other side, they go by what's cost more, from my understanding. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. If they can charge you more for something, they will. If they can get a certain thing on the insurance versus another thing, that will dictate it rather than the actual doctor's acumen. Now, in developing countries, actually, that's probably a similarity in a low resource setting. It comes from what do we have available? But I've found actually, in that limited technology state, the human brain and that human connection kicks in more. And it looks outside of the hospital setting itself, not just what medications, what do we have in our community? What herbal medicines do we have? What knowledge do we have in the community that can come in and help with this situation?
Yeah.
You know, or how can we even build something that will be able to fix this situation.
Yeah, and again, I'm not an expert on healthcare in the United States or insurances, but I think there's a lot of fee-for-service work that's done. So a lot of times billing will be done based on the insurance company's plan. If there's fee-for-service, they bill per service. In the United States, I think we spend more on healthcare in the last year of our lives than we do anything else because of the emphasis on technology and prolonging life at the end of life. There may be some health insurance companies that don't cover Ayurvedic practices, that don't cover other types of complementary medicine. So, and I think just hearing again with my former doctor who was into integrative medicine, she said most doctors are going to reject the idea of supplements or any other type of complementary care, and they're going to push Western medicine solutions towards you. So, yeah, I like the idea of, again, community coming together because especially there might be different practices that they can pull that improve the community as a whole. And it also gives individuals in that community an option in terms of which practices they want to avail themselves of because of the emphasis on knowing thyself, knowing your body, and knowing what's best for you. So I think if we could take that practice and incorporate that all over the world, I think you would see differences in quality of life throughout the entirety of our life.
Absolutely. it just brings to light, though, that who is actually dictating your treatment?
Yes.
For instance, in the UK, you have a body that dictates how doctors should behave and treat and stay in line. You have guidelines, you have all of this. Yes, it's the doctor's acumen, their diagnostic skills and everything, but at the end of the day, although they might say up here, this is what you need, then they have to refer to, okay, these guidelines, and my governing body says that I cannot do this. And before you know it, it's not actually the doctor that's making the call 100%. They're just implementing it for the patient.
Yes. Yeah. And that's, and they become basically an implementer as opposed to a collaborator.
Which is why, for me, it's so important that patients take that empowered action, do the research themselves, and then you take that responsibility. I think a lot of people are scared that if they take the responsibility, they're also the ones to blame.
Yeah.
So if something goes wrong, it's going to be, well, we told you so.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the last thing anybody wants to hear, particularly
right?
With the fragility of having a chronic illness or a terminal illness. We're fragile enough as it is. To hear that kind of rejection from I told you so, from a medical professional is even I think heightens their anxiety even more, with their healthcare challenges. So it isn't just a matter of I told you so, it's a matter of just allowing an individual to become empowered to try to feel what's best for them. And if it isn't, we have a conversation about why it didn't work, and well, let's maybe see what we can do to tweak what you've done. Let's take a look at maybe some other options, and you decide whether or not those are fit for you. And I think if we took that approach, you're going to get more, I think, engaged doctor-patient relationships, and the parts where we're not looking at patients as a number, we're looking at them as a person. I wanted to say that I did like the fact that it's like, yeah, what the Patch Adams movie. I don't care about their diagnosis. What's their name? And if you do that, you can remember their person by name. Boy, that little tweak that you make in developing a relationship makes all the difference in the world.
And I have not seen that more powerfully than when I was in Greece, like you mentioned, working with Mediquali. You're seeing all of these patients who have come from countries in turmoil, refugees, asylum seekers. They enter Greece. They've been quite literally running away from danger, running for their lives. They're then brought to detention camps. The point that they see us, we were doing mobile clinics.
Yep.
We have what medicine we have, and we go to these clinics. We set up makeshift clinics, sometimes even in storerooms, in community centers. And I remember one clinic, our field coordinator, he's a non-medic, but he sits outside on the reception. And we had an influx of Sudanese gentlemen. And they were coming in, and he said, these guys, before they came in to see you, were terrified. Like, they looked so terrified, everything. And every single one of them, when they left, was smiling, looked so much more relaxed. And he said, what on earth were they coming in with? What were you treating? And I said, honestly, we probably gave out 2 sachets of medication to all of them overall in the whole clinic. But what they actually get in those clinics is somebody seeing them as a human.
Yes.
Seeing the person that they are, connecting with them, and telling them that what you have gone through is an extraordinary situation. It is out of the ordinary. I cannot appreciate what you've gone through, but what you're feeling is completely ordinary for that extraordinary situation.
Yes.
And just for them to hear that, you know what, this is something that I'm going to experience now. It's temporary and it's going to get better. And that just even somebody's heard me.
Yes.
That was the most powerful. No medication can do that.
Yeah. And particularly with the health challenges that we experience at any time in our lives redefine our narrative. And I think whenever we go to a doctor, the circumstances that contributed to that or did not contribute to that. It's part of their story. And if doctors can bear witness to that and validate that, validate the normalcy of fear, of anxiety, of uncertainty, and basically be a companion to them on the path, that's going to, I think, enhance the quality of care, period. And the other thing is, I look at this as, if an individual is trusting me enough with their story of some of the most intimate details of their lives, I consider that to be the ultimate gift, because they can go anywhere. If I was a doctor, they could get a second opinion, or they could maybe, they could not have chosen me. So if they chose me, I need to take that their decision with the utmost respect and, you know, honor, and just honor whatever comes as a result of that, and particularly the personal details that have dictated their current health state, as opposed to, well, these are the symptoms, this is what we're going to do for symptom management. Who we are, how we were raised, what culture we were brought in has gotten us to this point, and we can use that background as rich information to do effective individualized treatment with individuals.
Yes. They come at their most vulnerable, and so they're the most impressionable. And the narrative they take out of that discussion also stays with them. If I tell you, like the client that I have, you don't do this, you are not going to survive, that stays with you. Mm-hmm. That's probably more detrimental than the actual condition he had to begin with.
Oh, absolutely.
We've spoken about this before, but when somebody is given a cancer diagnosis, for instance, if they decide and they're told you have 6 months, mm-hmm. and in their head they have 6 months, research has shown, there is evidence that as soon as you succumb to that, almost to the day, 6 months later, they pass away. Now, the people who decide that they're going to outlive this, they're going to outshine it, without a doubt, they do.
Oh, yeah.
And so the narrative a doctor, again, I say they are the most vulnerable when they walk into that doctor's office.
Mm-hmm.
And if you plant that seed that you are going to be on this medication forever, you are going to have this condition forever, that's it. That becomes a part of that person's story and their identity.
Yeah. You know, it's almost like the healthcare version of the placebo effect. If I give you a sugar pill and tell you it's going to reduce your anxiety, if you attach the expectation that I placed on that pill, and you're going to expect that I'm no longer anxious because I'm taking a pill that my doctor said was going to relieve the anxiety, when in reality, it was the expectation attached to it, not the actual chemicals in the pill that did that.
Is that a phrase that I recently started using? People don't break our hearts, they break our expectations.
Yeah, that's a profound statement in its simplicity.
Yeah.
But it's basically the approach that we take that will dictate, I think, you're right, that the healthcare outcomes that an individual perceives. And if their self-esteem is externally determined, if they look at other sources outside of themselves, they're going to buy right into that. And that's the other part where knowing that type of history comes in. You know, I think that the assessment by history, I think, should tailor the approach that doctors and other medical practitioners take. If I come from an unhealthy family system where I was totally disempowered, I don't want to ask questions, or I want to be mindful of any dialogue that's going to recreate those dynamics. So I think it's important, you know, we do assessment. It's just not medical history, it's the social history, cultural history, everything that I think dictates the strategies that we take when we're working with individuals in a collaborative fashion.
For sure. And that's what I picked up along the way, that traditional medicine done around the world, they ask exactly that, you know. In India, they might ask you, well, what's your family god?
Yeah.
What? There's all of these little elements that come into it, because there's so much more to a person. So their health is so much more than just this tiny condition that's going on. And that's where I feel we need to stop ignoring all the practices that are going on in the world and try to see how we can integrate them. That's where the integrative medicine Yes. really comes in as well.
And that is the wave of the present and the future.
Yeah.
Radha. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I was just going to say, in that sense, we don't need to reinvent medicine. We just need to remember its purpose, in that it's to heal, it's to serve, it's to empower. And when we bring that intention back and into every consultation room, but even into every classroom, every part of our culture, then the world is going to heal so much faster than we can imagine.
Absolutely. And it's about healing, and it's about healing not only in our individual cities or states, but it's promoting those practices throughout the world.
Yeah.
Radha, one of my last questions for you today, and you've left us with a lot, but I'm going to ask you if you can give our audience one ultimate takeaway from today, what would that be?
I think if we can combine or remember to combine science with soul, that is where we will not just heal individuals, but we'll heal the system. Because health isn't built in hospitals, it's built in your homes, in your hearts, in your habits. So whether you're a doctor, a teacher, a parent, just remember, you as an individual are the health system, not just for yourself, but probably for somebody else.
I think that's beautiful, wise, and sage advice. I like that. Combined science with soul. I may have to use that if you don't
mind. Please do. Please.
And I'll make sure I attribute it. I attribute it properly. I'll make sure I attribute it to you, Radha. So my last question, people want to get in touch with you, contract for your services. Just what's the best way for them to do that?
So if you have enjoyed conversations like this, then please come and join my Facebook community. It's where I host weekly lives, share practical tools, answer questions. If you prefer podcasts like this, Dave already mentioned, I have my podcast, Medicine Unraveled, where you can explore how I bridge science and soul in healthcare.
In Medicine Unraveled, I'm sure that's all on all the major podcast platforms, Apple, Spotify.
Exactly.
Are you on YouTube as well, too?
I'm building a presence on YouTube as well.
Okay. I'll make sure all of that information and your contact information and ways to contact on social media and your podcast, it gets in our episode notes when we go live on all of my podcast platforms. Radha, with that, thank you so much for another great conversation. I truly enjoy the time that we spend together, and I hope we can do this again in the future sometime.
Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity to share some of our wisdom and conversations with others.
You're welcome, and thank you for taking the time to do so.
Of course.
And with that, that's a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.